Okay, so what I'd like to do is actually say a few words about physics, but also say a few words about working with undergraduates, since this is sort of one of the main topics that we've been discussing. And so I'm actually going to say a few words of introduction in terms of the framework in which all these projects were done. But I'd like to hopefully emphasize, we'll see how the time goes, projects that I did with Mike Seifert, Kevin Setter, and Thomas Konopka. These people were graduates from Swarthmore and Hamilton. The least amount of time with this, working with the student was Thomas Konopka, and he worked with him for 8 months. The most was 2 years with Kevin Setter. And I'll say a few, hopefully say a few more words about that as I go along. Yeah, I was a leave replacement person, so visiting assistant professor there at Swarthmore right after a postdoc. So what is quantum gravity? Well, what I'd like to say is, first of all, there are lots of frameworks for quantum gravity, but what I'm going to do is concentrate on one of those and this approach, which is the quantization of the field theory of gravitation. I emphasize that simply as to at least get the basics of what's going on. In particular, I'm not looking at the gravitization of quantum mechanics, which is also a pursuit, and also a method of getting at something that might be quantum gravity. Of course, these quantum gravity must have two theories as limits, general relativity and quantum theory. And just to see what we're up against just briefly, it's a nasty problem. It's a problem that's puzzled people for well over 70 years with mixed success. So why? Well, general relativity, for instance, is a theory which, in which time and space are and geometry are dynamical. There's no background. That's the lingo we use. And that's quite in contrast to quantum theory, where we have a fixed background. General relativity has continuous geometry. And in quantum theory, we expect discrete quantities, energy, angular momentum, and so forth, are quantized. And then there's other differences as well. In general relativity, geometry determines motion, and matter, which is the thing that's moving, perhaps, determines the geometry. While in quantum mechanics, there's this is what I like to call this quantum haze. There's an uncertainty between conjugate quantities, and then there's all sorts of other interesting things like superposition of states, entanglement, measurement theory, and so forth and so on. Okay, some of which, in this approach of quantization of the field theory of gravitation, just carry over directly, and still are problems. And so there's lots of different approaches to this, but what I'd like to do is concentrate on one. And that is something called, that's variously called quantum geometry or loop quantum gravity. And in that framework, the states of space, so really the kinematics of what you'd want for quantum gravity, are known as spin networks. And they're what we might call good quantum numbers for space, that is to say geometry. And so let me explain a little bit about them, since this is all these undergraduate projects were based on this framework. First of all, what we do is we have a graph, and this graph is one piece, is one quantum number that describes the geometry. And so a graph is simply a set of vertices and edges, and they're connected, and they can be complicated connections between them, so they could be knotted and other such things. And again, just to remind you, this is kinematics of quantum gravity. Dynamics is still a troublesome issue. In fact, may sink the whole program. Who knows? We don't know yet. And of course, Shakespeare knew this, naturally, when he wrote, "O time, thou must untangle this, not I, for it is far too hard a knot for me to untie." So clearly, he was thinking ahead when he wrote that in Twelfth Night. There are two other pieces to this framework, or this description, or good quantum number. One is these vertices are actually labeled. And the edges are labeled. Okay? And so you can think of a state of space here as just a graph and two sets of labels, one a label for every vertex and one label for every edge. Now, I add one other little thing to this, and that is that we're not perhaps as far from undergraduate physics as you might guess, because these labels on these edges are in fact angular momenta, exactly as you might learn in a second or first course in quantum mechanics. And these vertices are really just more or less complicated forms of coupling of different angular momentum. So you might think about them as spin orbit coupling or combinations of angular momenta. This also has interesting ramifications for other things. If the label on these is just 1/2, then of course this is a spin 1/2 particle. And then one can go off in the wonderful tangents in quantum mechanics, and people like Roger Penrose and John Massuris did this many years ago, looking at possible ways where they might reconstruct angles in three-dimensional space. Now, why in the world does this kind of structure, which I've just plunked in front of you, have anything to do with general relativity or quantization of the field theory of gravity? I can't explain the whole thing right now. That would take a very long time. But let me just give you a couple of indications of why this might arise. Well, the first thing you do is you choose a different set of variables than just the metric for general relativity. You choose things that are much more related to things that are in field theory. So let's take an electric field-like thing and a vector potential-like thing. And these are like in the sense that these are really, this is a SU2 connection. And so there's a big complication there when dealing with undergraduates, of course, immediately. Do I go through this? Do I teach them non-abelian gauge theory, or do I not? Well, of course, that's difficult to do, so I generally do not do that. There was one student who wanted to sort of go into that area, and so started to do so. But let me just give you a taste of this. So these labels on these edges comes from just labeling the phases, and these are now sort of SU2 sort of things, so angular momentum kind of labelings. And this E here, this electric field-like thing, it's really the square root of the metric, and it really tells us how to transform back to flat space, should we desire to do so. And it is the momentum in this picture, while the configuration, the X, is really this connection. Yes. Good. Well, yes, close. Just dense dots and so forth, but that's basically what it is. So let me just say a few words about what we do with geometry in this picture. So if you want to do something, we need to be able to measure things, so we need to have operators. So there's operators for geometry, and those, for instance, are things like area. So in calculus, we might just integrate an area, say the surface area of this whale here, by just taking an integral over the appropriate region. In general relativity, if we look at a situation where we might have some curve coordinates or some curve geometry, then we have to worry about the metric. That's like the square root of g. And in these variables, this what are called connection variables, these metric is just spatial metric, so just what is the geometry of space. That's just given by the square of this electric field. So what do we do in the quantum mechanical context, or the quantum geometry context? Well, what we do is we determine what the operator is by quantizing it. And again, this is not something I do with undergraduates, but I just want to give you a quick flavor for that, and sort of see in a little more detail about how in the world this angular momentum comes out of this. And the answer is that when quantized, this electric field-like thing actually turns into, this is G, Newton's constant. Here's a sine factor, and then this here you can think about as the regular angular momentum operator. Okay, so that provides a connection to something that undergraduates might be more familiar with. Okay, so what happens to the area operator? What happens to it in terms of what is the area operator after it's quantized? Well, it looks something like this. These spin networks are nice things. They are the really the home space. Anybody use Chester? Chester is a textbook of quantum mechanics that I grew up with. I don't teach with it now, but he calls these the home space. So the it's the eigenspace for the area operator and on other geometric quantities. So we have a simple relation like this, just an eigenvalue problem. And so what you find is that the eigenvalue, if you have a single edge that passes through your surface you're trying to find the area of, that single edge endows the surface with some area. And that area depends on just j plus 1, that familiar j squared eigenvalue from quantum mechanics. Key things about these operators, and area is just one example, they have discrete spectra, and the edges are flux lines of area, that we just saw that here. The fact that the edge passed through the surface gives that surface some area when you were to measure it. Also, there's an area quanta in the sense that the smallest possible label you can have on this edge is 1/2, and so that gives you a sort of quanta of area, which is related to the Planck length. And just to remind you, that's very small, 10 to the minus 35 meters. Okay? So things look fairly hopeless in terms of going out and finding an appropriate quantum ruler which will do this for you. Now.
What determines the scaling neuron?
Yeah, so the it just comes from Planck's constant and G. It comes directly from general relativity and quantum mechanics. And there's, let me just, since you're so wise enough to ask this at this moment, there's also one other parameter that comes in this. So there's, I've written here effective scale, and so there's an additional ambiguity in the quantization process. And so that's some parameter that goes in, and it'll just be a proportionality between the Planck length that we just naively write down, 10 to the minus 35 meters, and this actual effective scale. Okay. Mm-hmm.
You say that the area is very small because of the Planck length entry again, but can't J
enlarge? Oh, yes. You bet.
And
oh,
then
yes.
You would have a quantum of area that could conceivably be.
That's right. So, but again, if J is very, very large, then we have lots of connection there, which means we have lots of curvature. So if this thing was a very, very large J edge of the spin network, then all sorts of exciting things would happen around this, you know, orbiting and all those good things. Okay, so just let me add as just a finishing touch to this, and that is that if you have lots of edges passing through that surface, then what happens to the eigenvalue? Well, you just sum all the contributions of J squared. This should be a square root on each of these, okay? So it's just a sum of each contribution of edge. There's not sort of a interactive kind of situation here. They just individually contribute to the whole area. Okay. All right.
Just some incoherent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let me just talk about one operator, other operator quickly, and this one I will do quite quickly. If we just have classically an angle, we can express that angle as a cosine. Take a couple vectors, dot them together, divide by their magnitudes. You can do something similar, and I'll just flash this because I need it in a moment. You can do something similar quantum mechanically or in this quantum geometry, and you get a similar expression to what we had before. Just I want you to concentrate on this part down here, that the angle operator is just, again, results in an eigenvalue theta here, and it's given by this expression here, sort of inverse cosine of that expression. When we need that again, I'll provide it to you for you again. So now I'd like to spend the rest of the time talking about two or three, depending on how the time goes, projects that I actually did with undergraduates on this. Okay, so first of all, this is work with Mike Seifert. He was at Swarthmore when I was there, and worked with me for one summer, and then he did his honors thesis after that. And just as a curious side note, yes, you know this story, he was an APCR finalist. I had all kinds of high expectations for him going into this because he was incredibly independent, did amazing work, and yet there's this some guy from ISU, right? This Roger guy who had 13 publications. How is it possible? So, of course, he got it that year. But anyway, so Mike did a great job, and it also fortunately survived September 11th because the talks were exactly that time period. They're supposed to be flying on that day. But anyway, what do we do? Well, it's very complicated stuff trying to determine what the geometry might be like with spin networks, since there's lots of operators. I've shown you some of the more simple ones. Certainly the angle one is more simple. So what I decided to do for when Mike inquired about a project is to concentrate on a very restricted context, and that was a single vertex. So let's study a single vertex and ask one question, and that is, what must that vertex or spin network look like? What are its properties to model continuous geometry? So that was the idea. It also, let me remind you of a couple things that I perhaps didn't say, but angle is based on a vertex, and also the volume operator is based on a vertex, and then also proposals for the Hamiltonian constraint, so something that might provide us with a four-dimensional formulation also is based on a vertex. So how did we, what did we do to answer this question? This was how do we model continuous geometry? Well, first of all, we looked at the spectrum of the angle operator.
Sorry, yep. What's the main point of continuous geometry? Is that
imaginary? That's That's the idea, but we are just going directly at, we have these operators, we have, say, the angle and area and volume. So what are the relationships between those operators that we'd expect classically? That is to say, in a continuous geometry. So I'll explain a little more detail about what we did. So looking at this spectra, so this, what we graph here is the total spin in that vertex, and then the eigenvalues for the operator, the angle operator. You notice a couple things immediately. First of all, small angles are hard to model with this setup, in the sense that you have to go for very, very high spin to see these small angles. The other thing is this spectrum is non-uniform. First of all, is just a couple of quick results. We just looked at, well, what does it take to have small angles? So we want to make sure that we have small angles in this setup. Well, that was a fairly easy calculation. All we had to do is look at that inverse cosine. It's a good warm-up calculation. You want to get the angles as small as possible, and so the cosine as close to 1 as possible. And so you just have to do a sort of a min-max problem, subject to some things called triangle identities, which are required by angular momentum addition. And so we just got a result. You have to have large n to get small angles. The uniform spectrum argument is a little bit longer, so I'm going to leave that aside. And then we also looked at the distribution of angles. So in three-dimensional space, we have a distribution of angles, which goes like sine theta d theta. And so this is something I just want to highlight. We had talked extensively about these sorts of things early in the project. This was something that Mike did on his own, literally, completely on his own. In particular, he did this wonderful little thing. He noticed, well, if you assume that every possible way of building a vertex is equally probable, then what we should do is figure out an appropriate limit such that we get a sine function for that probability. And what he did with how he solved this was he had just taken discrete math, and what he did is he mapped this onto a project, a problem, which was a problem on a lattice. So if you count the total number of paths through this lattice of a certain type, I just draw a little cartoon to indicate the sort of nature of the problem. If I went into details, it would take too long. So what he did is he mapped this ways of building this spin network vertex onto this paths in a space, and then looked up in the mathematical literature, found the solution, and said, yay, hooray, and then I wrote down the rest, okay? And extremely impressive, a little piece of work for him, okay? I will also say that of the students that I mentioned, he was perhaps the most independent in that he sort of came up with independent methods on his own and so forth. It was rather wonderful. Okay, now what I'd like to do is say a couple words about Tomasz Konopka's work. It looks like, and that's what I'll have time for, but we'll see. Okay, so for lots of us working in this field, there's a major lurking question, and that is physics. Is this really just playing with a little bit of mathematics with maybe some physics insight? Can we really make any contact to physics at all? Let me just again show you some disappointing take on this. You can follow Laplace and ask at what regime would you expect some sort of interesting behavior out of general relativity, and you get the Schwarzschild radius here. Okay. Now, if you look at quantum mechanics, you might say, well, if the Compton wavelength was approximately the Schwarzschild radius, that's this equation here, what do you get? Well, you get something like these length scales I just mentioned, 10 to the minus 35 meters, or an energy scale of 10 to the 19 GeV. Now, let's sort of just try to figure out what is the order of merit. How good is this sort of known experimental work? How close does it come to this energy scale? It's very depressing, right? So if you take the energy scale of the LHC, say, for example, and you take this quantum gravity scale, you get something like 10 to the minus 16, which would be, if you were playing soccer, that would be like playing finding the quark mass from playing soccer. So that is to say, just particle collisions on the scale of everyday world and trying to find the quark mass from that. So clearly, as one might say in New England, you ain't going to get there from here, right? So it's
what
not going to be possible.
Is, Planck mass and Planck
yes, right. Yeah. That's right. I could have just gotten this out of dimensional analysis. Right. Okay. But the key thing I wanted to point out here is that a high energy experiment is not going to currently give us any appropriate sort of constraints, as far as we know, just using this sort of naive argument. So, is it really? Can we really ask this question? Okay. So there was a couple of years ago considerable excitement, at least for some of us, by some early calculations, which showed that if you use semi-classical quantum gravity states, that is to say, you look at this quantum geometry stuff, figure out, well, if I have to have some sort of appropriate behavior of geometry, what happens to the matter? What happens to the Hamiltonians or the propagation of matter on these states? And so interesting stuff. First of all, it destroys familiar stuff. We no longer have Lorentz invariants. So I'm going to just describe the most optimistic means that this is stuff that we might be able to see now. Okay, so these calculations showed that if you looked at the dispersion relations, so just looked at the Hamiltonian, found sort of a wave-like modes, and then looked at the appropriate dispersion relations, they had cubic corrections. Okay, so what we normally have, say, for a massive field is so energy squared is equal to momentum squared plus mass squared, but we'd have additional thing, which is some parameter that, boy, if we really knew this theory well, we'd be able to tell you that that was 0.3 or something. And then you have the Planck length or the Planck scale, so something very small. So in everyday special relativistics context, this thing would be essentially zero, and so we're back to where we want to be. And then this would be multiplied by the momenta cubed, and here it's not. This isn't something that carries the sign of momenta, it's really the absolute value of momenta cubed. Okay, so what happens, right? What happens to particle processes? And this is just a beautiful project for an undergraduate. Why? Well, because they've done some relativity in the past. Maybe they haven't really fully understood it, but boy, this gives an opportunity to do so. Okay, so what happens to particle processes? And so this is quantum gravity phenomenology for undergraduates. How fun. Okay. And key point here, how new, right? When we started on this, there was one other group doing this. And the just because it was so new, it's simple stuff, frankly. And so when you're breaking into new territory, and if you just happen to get lucky, you know, undergraduate physics is leading edge physics, right? Because here we are doing special relativity kinematics with a change, okay? And it turned out there were subtleties that had been missed before. And anyway, so There happened to be a little bit of beauty in all this, in the sense of a great opportunity for an undergraduate to contribute significantly. Okay, so all kinds of crazy things happen if you add this extra term. Photons can decay; they can be unstable at certain energies. Electrons can emit Cherenkov radiation in vacuum. So the point is that since you have this additional term, what happens is that the speed of light at high energy may not be the speed of light at low energy. The speed of electrons might in fact exceed the low energy speed of light, and so then you're getting into a situation just like in the Cherenkov situation in a media where this can occur. Also, I think I won't have time to mention, but you can also maybe solve a outstanding problem. Okay. Now,
Are you talking to the people at the OJ Observatory about GDK business?
Yes. In fact, at a conference not long ago, Ted Jacobson called the OJ Observatory a quantum gravity laboratory. Well, yes. Okay. All this crazy new stuff is great because you can actually constrain it, right? And the point is that we can actually maybe someday, I mean, we're already starting to get this, but maybe someday we can go from some sort of observation and say, sorry, no, that doesn't exist. So therefore, what you had up here doesn't exist. And so therefore, maybe we can modify the theory. That full chain cannot happen at this point, in part because these calculations are not sophisticated enough to really sort of feed back into the theory, unfortunately. It'll happen soon, I hope. Yes, here they are. Okay. So if you consider these processes I just mentioned, so let's just give one example to start with. If you observe a 10 TeV photon from the Crab Nebula, which has been observed, then, well, that photon's stable. Okay, so it hasn't decayed at all, so therefore it's stable. Therefore, it rules out this region of parameter space, what's sort of dark up here. Okay, and this parameter space I'm graphing here is kappa for photons versus kappa for electrons. So what we did is we built a sort of phenomenological model. We had different possible kappas for the different types of particles. Okay, so that rules out, and you know, this is order one, right? This already has been reduced by the Planck length, or the Planck scale. So this is exciting stuff. 5 years ago, we just said, never possible, not in my lifetime. But here we are doing something that looks like some sort of constraint on these parameters. Of course, how do we do there? Well, we got there through Lorentz violations, which are very, very tightly constrained. So the other constraint here that you see most obviously is a vacuum Cherenkov radiation, and that knocks off all of this territory here. Okay, and then there's another constraint which will put a floor on this. I should also add that this is work that I did with Tomas Konopka. In intervening time, the other group, which had a postdoc and a graduate student, was able to constrain this much more tightly. Okay. All right. So I think I'm more or less out of time. So I unfortunately, I won't mention too much about what Kevin Setter did, though that was also wonderfully productive. Over 2 years, two summers, in fact, we did a couple of publications. Let me just finish with the reflections on so much on the physics or the quantum gravity, but reflections on working with undergraduates. So what worked for me? So these are sort of three successful experiences. I've worked with other graduates as well, less successful, but still somewhat successful. So what I'd like to sort of summarize is these things. First of all, know your student. If you have them in classes, then you can get to know them, what their strengths are, and you can sort of direct them in possible directions which they might be able to contribute. Let them choose somewhat. So I in a couple of cases, I asked, they sort of chose directions. The strongest case I didn't have time to talk about, Kevin Setter, in a series of conversations during the academic year, he would come in every Friday, we'd just chat for a while, and by the end of the year, we had figured out a project for him, which then carried through 2 years, year and a half. So. The other is plan on teaching. I always get surprised at the beginning of the summer, a little depressed, when I have students in front of me and I think, oh dear, two to 3 months of teaching. Well, it is. It's a lot of teaching before they can really contribute. And with that in mind, it's worth working with them longer term. Senior projects are absolutely fabulous for this. And the other thing I would say that this is a highly speculative field, and one has to be very careful about their enthusiasm. So they could get very, very enthusiastic about the stuff they're working on and say, well, I want to work on this in graduate school. And you have to say, wait, wait a moment. You want to make sure that, just like if you involve high schoolers, perhaps, you don't want to blind them to other possibilities. You definitely don't want to blind them to other possibilities here, particularly when considering things like career, their future career. So that's another element that I've learned. The other is to ask, personally, where am I? So. Working with these undergraduates has been fabulous, but it really took my entire time. So I was not working on anything that involved a much more sophisticated background. And so it was wonderful to do, but I have to, before 50 years go by, I have to ask, is this something I really want to do, or do I want to follow a research direction that may require some background which they just simply don't have access to? Okay, thank you.